This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Ruth Conniff, the political editor of The Progressive Magazine, subbing in for Matthew Rothschild, who's on vacation. Today, it is a thrill to have in our studio with me Arundhati Roy, the great novelist and activist from India, who's the author most famously of The God of Small Things, and also many other books, including Walking with Comrades and Field Notes on Democracy, Listening to Grasshoppers. Welcome to the Progressive Radio Show, Arundhati Roy.
Thank you so much, Ruth.
I wanted to start by talking about The God of Small Things, which I found to be one of the greatest novels I've ever read, has had an incredible impact on me. And I think about, I've read a lot of novels that I remember liking, but The God of Small Things comes back to me. I remember scenes from it all the time. And I think the reason is that you captured in that book this very personal impact of cultural and political forces on individual people's lives. And there's something about that that I just can't get over. So I'd like to talk to you a little bit about what you think the connection between art and politics is, and also ask you, as everyone probably does, whether you're working on another novel that will come out anytime soon.
Yes, actually, I am working on another novel, and I don't know when it'll come out because, you know, I'm very early stages in the writing of it. The connection between art and politics is a complete one, I think. You know, as far as I can tell, for me, even a fairy tale is a political document in some ways. You know, it depends on how upfront the politics is, or how much you have to read into it. But it is, and for me, writing, like you said, The God of Small Things, the real challenge in writing fiction is connecting the big things to the small things. How culture and history and politics invades the smallest spaces, you know, the relationships between siblings or mothers and children or families. And that is, to me, the most challenging part of writing a book, a novel. I was here actually in Madison because school children, high school children had been reading The God of Small Things and in some program called The Great World Texts, and they had gathered at the university, and I was so astonished and heartbroken and thrilled to see how they had delved into the book and how they had taken things out of it and held them as light to their own life, you know. So you had, I mean, to imagine that children in a Madison high school were looking at, you know, the love laws mentioned in The God of Small Things and translating it into what was going around the politics of same-sex marriage, or people, young children doing projects on the difference between the Marxist Party and the Marxist-Leninist Party in India, and the connections between caste and class in class in the United States, or, you know, just writing poems or music. It was such an exhilarating experience as a writer for me to see the way something can spark so much creativity in so many people. And it reminded me so much of the fact that, you know, even though I wrote the book so many years ago and people try and sort of separate fiction from politics, actually, you just cannot.
Yeah. I'm Ruth Conniff, subbing in for Matt Rothschild, and we're talking with Arundhati Roy, the author of The God of Small Things and the activist from India. I'm not surprised that the high school students were really moved by that book. And I think there is something both tragic but also empowering about that feeling of what it's like to be a person struggling against these huge global forces. And of course, this is a lot of your work and your political activism today. You gave a speech in New York to the Occupy movement that touched me and people around the world, I think, very deeply, talking about how all of us citizens, not the great corporations and powerful militarized government forces, but regular citizens were really trying to take back power. And I wonder if you could just give us a little update on what you think is happening now. I mean, here in Wisconsin, we witnessed something tremendous in the resistance to our governor, Scott Walker, with so many people, 100,000 people in the streets, and that moment of a sense of power. And now we're in a moment of setback where those forces seem to have prevailed. You wrote recently that in India, you think there is a really hopeful sense that that Indians have not been completely colonized by consumerism, that there's real hope that ordinary people can take control. Can you talk a little bit about what's hopeful to you and what you think is happening now?
I think depending on a number of things, I sometimes may sound more hopeful than I should or ought to be. But I think, you know, the fact that the Occupy movement has been pushed back doesn't mean that, you know, we should feel bad that it happened. It was a wonderful thing that it happened. And it, I think it ignited and changed something in people's minds. It changed the language on the street. The danger in India as well as in the US is that every time there's a radical mass movement, it gets broken by election campaigns, you know. And I think that's what happened. The Occupy movement was completely split into people who wanted to stay on and others who actually just got involved in the Obama versus Bush campaign, which happens in India too a lot, you know, that movements do get broken all the time and have to regroup. But in India, the difference, I suppose, is that people, many people are just, they don't have a choice. You know, they have nothing to go back to. It's not that they can come out and protest and in a way go back. That happens in the cities and in the, you know, where there is a middle class that comes out, that's angry and then retreats. Whereas out of the cities in villages where these big mining corporations are taking over people's land, there is nowhere to retreat to. So you have a huge resistance that is on, and you see that the poorest people in the world are resisting the biggest and the most powerful corporations. And the people don't always win, but the corporations are having a very, very difficult time, because really what they are trying to do is a kind of occupation of people's lands, of the commons, and they are being helped by hundreds of thousands of paramilitary. Now the government, Indian government, is planning to deploy the army in forest areas to push out indigenous people. Now, these battles have obviously been fought for centuries. They have been fought. I mean, indigenous people have been wiped out in North America and Canada and Australia. All these battles have been fought before. But today, you know, in India, for example, the language of rights and democracy and all of that coexists with this program of a kind of annihilation. And it's a very interesting moment. You know, given what we know about the environment now and given what we understand about colonialism and globalization, all these arguments have sort of coalesced into a single geographical space, and the battles are being fought, you know, with the gloves off now.
You actually went into the jungle and spent some time with the Maoist resistance in India, which was both, I think, incredibly physically courageous on your part, and also extremely controversial in India. And there's a statement attributed to you that you called the Maoist Gandhians with guns. What did you mean by that? And what do you think the significance of the Maoist resistance in India is, and how does it relate to this worldwide Occupy movement?
Yeah, well, the statement about Gandhians with guns actually was just a copy editor's headline. It wasn't anything that I wrote in my essay. What I said was that let me start from who are the Maoists and what's going on there. As I said, you know, sometime in 2005, the Indian government had signed something like 200 or 300 memorandums of understanding with major infrastructure and mining companies, private corporations, basically handing over the forests and the rivers and the mountains of central India, where all the indigenous people live, to these corporations. Now, some of them are deep in the forest and some of them are on the edges of the forest. And depending on the landscape of where people are, there are different kinds of resistance. In the forest, there's a Maoist guerrilla army. Outside, there are a range of militant movements, from Gandhian to socialist to just, you know, local movements. There's a sort of bandwidth, a diversity of resistance. Much of it depends on the landscape in which people are fighting. So what I did say was that when you're trying to tell indigenous people living deep in the forest, whose villages are being surrounded by thousands of paramilitary and burnt, and women are being raped, and when you're telling them to be nonviolent or Gandhian, what do you expect them to do? I mean, do you expect people who are already starving in the forest to go on a hunger strike? Do you expect them to sit under a tree and hold a sit-in while their villages are being burnt? You know, how can you preach that to somebody and feel moral? You know, how can you make these easy equations between nonviolence and morality? So the Maoists are the most militant end of a bandwidth of resistance movements. And when the government announced this open war against not just the Maoists, but against all these resistance movements, it was called Operation Green Hunt. And it's still going on. And they've sent these hundreds of thousands of paramilitary forces into these villages. And then the people resisted. And immediately they began to be called terrorists, you know. So I went into the forest because nobody really had been inside. There was a sort of cordon of silence around it. And and of course, when you say Maoist, it immediately sets off all kinds of bells. And I went in to see who were these people, who was part of the guerrilla army, what was really going on there. And I spent 2.5 weeks inside where there are shoot at sight orders, you know, as the police say. And I asked one of the policemen, you know, he kept showing me these photographs of dead young boys and girls and saying, you see, this is a Maoist, this is a Maoist, this is a Maoist. I said, how do you know they are Maoists? I mean, does it say...
The dead children were Maoists, or the Maoists had done this?
That no, that his people had killed all these Maoists, you know.
So these children
meaning
were
teenagers.
Maoists.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So I said, how do you know that they are Maoists? He says, look, they have malaria medicines and Dettol bottles and things from outside. So that was his definition of how you define a Maoist, you know. Now, of course, the government is planning to deploy the army as well as the Air Force. So we are at a very, very difficult situation. And of course, the elections are coming up, the general elections in 2014. And one of the main prime ministerial candidates is a man called Narendra Modi, who is the extreme right-wing BJP person, the four-time chief minister of Gujarat, under whose watch something like 100,000 Muslim people were driven from their homes and more than 1,000 were massacred on the streets of Gujarat. Women were raped and burnt alive, and he more or less justified all of this. But now he's become the darling of the middle classes because he's known as the development chief minister and is bringing in a lot of foreign direct investment and so on. So, and people are looking to him, in particular the corporations are looking to him to be the strong man, you know, to be able mm-hmm. to send in the army and stop the, you know, nonsense about you know, the outcry against Operation Green Hunt and so on.
I'm Ruth Conniff, political editor of The Progressive Magazine. We're talking with Arundhati Roy, the novelist and activist. You made an interesting comment. You have also been a polarizing figure in India because of your position on Kashmir. And I'm interested in your comment that while there's a lot of talk about Islamic militants leading the resistance to in Kashmir and the fight for independence there, that we have to understand Islamic militancy as a matter of class, and that you had said at one point part of the message from religious fundamentalists is you westernized middle class, you're having too much fun. You know, you have, you're enjoying sort of this consumerist culture too much, and that's part of the critique. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
No, I don't think I said any of those things.
Okay. So
I think maybe that was someone else. No, because I think that the situation in Kashmir is quite simply that Kashmir was never a part of India, really. It was an independent kingdom at the time of partition. And when partition happened, both India and Pakistan, it was sort of half of it was occupied by Pakistan and the other half by India. And being a Muslim majority region, you know, very early on, a fight for self-determination had begun. And for many years, it was an unarmed sort of struggle. And then in the 90s, after blatantly rigged elections, tens of thousands of young folks crossed the border, the line of control, and went and got trained and came back, and it became an armed struggle. And since then, what has happened is it's become the most militarized zone in the world. So you have between 500,000 to 700,000 troops there. 68,000 people have lost their lives. You know, last year they discovered mass graves. There's so much torture and repression and control of the press and control of people. And yet, because India gives out this, you know, we are such a shambling, you know, stuffed toy democracy. Sometimes things go wrong, but actually we are okay. You don't realize what a brutal country it can be. Because actually, if you look at it, since 1947, there hasn't been a single year when the Indian Army has not been deployed against people within the, you know, what India calls its own territory, whether it's Manipur, Nagaland, Mizoram, Kashmir, Telangana, Goa. The Indian Army is always at war within its own territory, you know, and now it's going to be deployed in central India. And the Kashmir is not actually and never has been some sort of Islamist fundamentalist state. It's always had a diverse, you know, many, many strains of Islam that people follow there. And yet it suits the Indian government to try and portray it as some Wahhabi state, you know. So those things that you read out, I don't recognize myself as having said it all. No.
Okay. Mm. This is Ruth Conniff. I'm the political editor of The Progressive Magazine. I'm interviewing Arundhati Roy. I want to segue to the Iraq War anniversary that we just passed. And you were an opponent of the invasion of Iraq 10 years ago. And now that we've passed this anniversary, I'm curious to know what you think Americans should take away from this experience of the Iraq War. You said recently that the psychosis of U.S. foreign policy prevails, even though George W. Bush is gone. What did you mean by that? And do you think that President Obama is as bad as George W. Bush from a global perspective?
Well, from a global perspective, I think there's not much to choose between him and Bush. I mean, President Obama has expanded the war into the sovereign territory of Pakistan. And Pakistan is now being torn apart, you know. So you have Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria. Now they're, you know, now they've, 2 days ago, they started talking about a game changer in Syria because, you know, they don't know who's using chemical weapons, though they probably supplied it to both sides. And so you have a situation where it looks as if it's a psychosis, which is, you know, look at the look at what's going on with Tony Blair. Says that Tony Blair says that it was one of the better decisions he made in his life, and now he's getting paid $500,000 a lecture to go and talk about morality and ethical behavior and God and so on. You know, Bush is painting self-portraits of himself in the shower, and Rumsfeld is congratulating people who participated in the war after killing 134,000 people, and the sanctions were more than a million. So what are American citizens to do? I think, well, perhaps it's a good question for all of us, because all of us seem to be strapped into some kind of straitjacket. And you know, the idea is that, are you going to again go out and vote for Democrats and Republicans, or Democrats and Republicans, when we know that this is what is going on? So until, in some ways, we are able to at least at least not participate so enthusiastically in what these governments are doing with us. It's the same thing in India. I mean, though people don't actually participate so enthusiastically. I mean, in India, this current government has actually 10% of the population voted for it in this great majority that it claims it has. And I think more people vote for the American idol than they do for the American government. But the problem is, we are faced with a crisis in our idea of democracy, because governments who claim to represent us do not. I mean, before the Iraq war, millions of people marched against it. None of the governments in anywhere cared about what people really wanted. So to answer your question, I mean, I think the danger of somebody like Obama is that he smokes up the mirrors, you know, and a lot of the opposition just thinks, oh, he's better than Bush, and so then it divides the opposition, whereas he's actually doing things, certainly in terms of foreign policy, which are sometimes worse than Bush.
This is Arundhati Roy speaking. Now, I'm Ruth Conniff, the political editor of The Progressive Magazine. Arundhati Roy, here in this country, we read a lot about India thanks to Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, who is ecstatic about India as a model of growth and the neoliberal policies that have been enacted there really since 1991, the end of the protectionist regime in India, which supported Indian industry. Sort of interesting to look back. I wonder what you think now in retrospect about that previous regime of protectionionism, and then how do you view this portrait of India that we get from people like Tom Friedman, who say Americans should look at the drive and the ambition and the excitement of workers in India, a little bit of fear that Indians are taking United States jobs. And I wonder in particular if you know anybody who works at a call center for a U.S. multinational corporation in India, because that's a big item in the news here, and what you think of this sort of view that we have of the rise of India, the growth, economic growth, and whether that's a model, as Tom Friedman seems to think it is, for the United States.
I want to be his tour guide when he comes to India next, you know, because what these years of opening up the markets and globalization has done is that, yes, of course, it's created a middle class with drive and ambition aggression and enthusiasm. That middle class right now, its exhilaration has turned to panic because the growth rate has dropped there as well.
But it's going down from 8 or 9% down to 5%.
Yeah. But we have a situation now where 800 million Indians live on less than half a dollar a day. So that middle class was created at the cost of a much, much larger underclass. You know, we have more poor people in India than all the poorest countries of Africa put together. And we have created a situation where, now the government and the old style of politics doesn't know what to do with this aggressive middle class that is always at the gates. It's hugely invested in the free market now. But the cost that the rest of the people are paying is so huge, which is why now India is slowly turning into a militarized and police state where, that is the situation that this kind of growth has created, the disparity where 100 people own wealth equivalent to 25% of the GDP. But the really big problem in India is that the big corporations like Reliance and Tata's and so on, who are at the head of the spigot, and they have this kind of cross ownership of businesses where they'll own, petrochemicals, power, cable TV, textiles, publishing, 27 television channels. They own or the manufacture of salt or bookshops. Vehicle manufacturer, weapons. So that eventually makes these few corporations, like Reliance, for example, RIL, it has something like $44 billion market capital. And so they actually run the country now. Mm. And they can twist the government's hand. They can shut the country down. They are distributing power, water, gas, everything, So I think until we stop this cross-ownership of businesses, these corporations, they are even antagonizing smaller businesses, because everybody is just being turned into a service industry that services these huge mega corporations which own the media and own infrastructure and own everything else.
There's not a lot of trickle down. You're saying it's a consolidation. Mm. We only have about a minute left. I'm Ruth Khan. If we're talking with Arundhati Roy, given that scope of the problem and that idea of growing inequality and this concentration of wealth and power and this handful of elites, which I think you've been part of a movement that really has come to understand that in a way that maybe a few years ago that consciousness wasn't as widespread. What do you think is the most important thing for progressives to do? Where should we be putting our energy?
Well, since we only have a few seconds, I would say in not cooperating, in distancing ourselves from the system instead of continuously hoping that, voting for the Democrats is going to change something or participating, let that happen. But our energies have to be in continuing, not disbanding the Occupy movement, Occupy and stay.
So stay with the progressive resistance worldwide.
Yes.
I've been talking with Arundhati Roy, who is a voice of the progressive movement and a wonderful novelist. You said you are at work on another work of fiction?
Yes.
So maybe we can hope for another novel like The God of Small Things, which
would be a fantastic novel. Difficult one to follow, but yes.
it is a hard act to follow. But you do so much great work, and I really have enjoyed talking with you. Thank you so much for being here on Progressive Radio.
Thanks for coming. Thank you.
Hi, again, I'm Ruth Conniff, political editor of the Progressive Magazine, in for Matt Rothschild, who's on vacation this week. We've been talking with Arundhati Roy, and I wish you luck in the rest of your tour here in the United States, and we'll really look forward to hearing from you some more.
Thanks, Ruth.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.